Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens, and here is today's episode. Folks, welcome to another episode of the Cripescast. Today, I am speaking with Polar Explorer and Expedition Guide, originally from Wisconsin. His name is Eric Larson. And before I get into that, I just want to, same as we've done the past few weeks, a lot of people are out there not sure how to effectively respond or respond in a way that that matters with the tragic humanitarian situation going on in Gaza right now. And a great organization that we've been supporting and you can support too is Doctors Without Borders. Follow them on Instagram, stay informed with what's going on, and they are doing everything they can to help with the hospitals. Hospitals have been bombed there. It's just a very dire humanitarian situation, leaving a lot of folks to feel helpless. But a simple way you can be helpful is following Doctors Without Borders, staying informed, and also donating to their organization. That's doctorswithoutborders.org. They are boots on the ground. They are there to help, and they're doing everything from humanitarian aid and medical supplies. I was listening to the radio earlier this week, and you know they're doing surgeries with no anesthesia, and it is a very terrible situation over there. And they are doing everything they can to help. Again, that is doctorswithoutborders.org. And make sure you follow them at Doctors Without Borders on all social media platforms. Colleen Maraca joins me in the podcast studio today. Colleen, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
Eric Larson is our guest today. And he is, first of all, he's a guy from Wisconsin who grew up with a love of the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And he reached out to you originally to
Cripescast or something, or I don't know. But as soon as you saw the stuff on the email, you're like, let's get him in.
Yeah, because this guy has been to the North Pole a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And on his most recent excursion, you were kind of able to see the real effects of climate change. He did essentially an episode with Discovery Channel going to the North Pole, showing sort of in real time what's happening with the shrinking ice. But he was able to do it. And I think just the connection he gives to these places that we often do not see yet are often the most hard hit by climate change. It offers a real interesting perspective on sort of our connection with the natural world. And of course, things we can do to help with climate change and all of that. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones is just making sure you get out and enjoy what we have right here in our own backyard and in Wisconsin, or really any state. But I'll speak to Wisconsin since I know it. We have so many state parks. We have national parks. We have the Ice Age Trail, the Apostle Islands. There's so many local ways to just get out and enjoy what we have here. Mm-hmm. And I think by that enjoyment, you then are inspired to keep it and keep it for future generations. So
I don't know where you were going there.
What do you mean?
I thought you were saying keep it, and then I didn't know if you were going to do like keep or move in, or I don't know.
Yeah. You thought I was going to put a little keep or move in thing in?
Yeah. The cool part about the interview that I liked, though, was him talking about his encounters with polar bears.
Yeah.
Like bears just, yeah. It's like, what is it? Brown get down, black attack, and white goodnight, because you're going to die if you run into a polar bear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know. They are one of the bears that hunt you. But also the reason, you know, they're even like creating more human encounters is because they're losing sea ice and everything. And that's how they hunt seals. So that mm-hmm. it's kind of like everything has its own place. But if you are in their territory, you know, then you're kind of fair game. They were stalked by them. They're moving these 100-pound sleds with them along the way. I mean, it's just crazy what he does.
It was cool.
But really interesting conversation, Wisconsin guy. I think you all will enjoy this quite a bit. Let's see here. Colleen hosted a Halloween party the Cripes team all went to. It was very fun. You were Willy Wonka.
I was, and I had my entourage with me.
You know, we were talking about that, too, of like, yeah, you had Oompa Loompas with you. There are those who choose to go as the Oompa Loompa, And then there are those who choose to go as Willy Wonka. Are you always choosing to go as the main character for your Halloween costume?
I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah, who was it last year?
Last year it was Shrek. I was Lord Farquaad and then Princess Fiona. But okay. Those aren't like...
So not always.
Not always, but like the ones that make the most sense for me. Is that a bug on the light?
Yeah, that's a stink bug. Yeah, it is. Folks, it is stink bug season out there. So if you see a stink bug,
sorry, that threw me off.
Don't be alarmed. Don't be alarmed like Colleen. They're a slow moving bug. They're not going to hurt you. They are just a part of the world we live in today.
Anyway.
Yeah.
No, and let me just like be super clear. You're trying to like throw me under the bus with my friends at the party, but I,
I was not.
You were.
Was I?
To my friend that was an Oompa Loompa, you were. You were like, that's crazy. It's so typical. And you're like, ha ha ha. But I was saying though, like I've already written down ideas for my next Halloween costume next year.
Oh my God.
And, but I came to them like about 2 months ago and I was like, I know what I'm going to be. I'm going to be Willy Wonka. And then my friends were like, should we do a group costume? We'll be Oompa Loompas. And I was like, great. Sounds good.
Okay.
And also people would argue that Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, Charlie is the main character.
Well,
Wonka's not.
It depends. It depends what we're reading, what we're going for. There's Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. There's also Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
It's almost from two different perspectives.
You know? Because I think the book originally was Willy Wonka. This Gene Wilder movie was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. I think the one I did might have been Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yep.
And then the new Wonka movie with Timothée Chalamet.
Who's Timothée Chalamet? What I know, but one. What is that?
That's coming out this year. It's called Wonka.
That's sort of the Wonka origin story. So no, it is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was the Gene Wilder. And then
Was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory mine?
Let me just see.
Shows you how selfless I am.
Yeah, I mean
I offered you Charlie. I literally offered you to join and you could have been Charlie or Grandpa.
I know. And you know what? We're wrong. The Johnny Depp one is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So
yeah, that's good for me.
I am wrong. You did not pick the main character.
Yeah.
So my whole point was moot.
The only thing that I wanted to do just was to have that hair, that wig.
It looked really good.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to, like, I just feel like that was such a good, like, the best Halloween costumes are the ones that, like, have multiple pieces and, like,
oh, okay. I'm going to take that as a dig because I was butter. I was just, but I brought a whip.
Yep,
whipped butter. So I had two pieces to my costume.
I had... at least 10 probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was well done.
Yeah.
It was well done.
But no, it was super fun and my apartment has candy all over the floor.
That's my fault. She had candy necklaces. She tried putting one on me. It broke because I just have a very big head. Shocking. And then the other one finally did
snapped at some point.
I tried to take it off, put it over the head
again. That candy was from last Halloween.
Okay.
So well, I don't really... it wasn't completely you. It probably was like old string or something.
Okay. Sounds good.
So don't feel too bad. Anyway, besides that, this week you're heading to Minnesota.
Yeah, we're doing 6 shows in Burnsville
yep.
For all you folks this weekend. I'm excited because we're going to Paisley Park with, Andy Prince. Roth. He's going to be there. Bill Doucette is. Don, our promoter, is going to be there. So Dante, it's going to be his birthday.
Yep.
And so we're going to go check out Paisley Park, check out Prince's.
Are you a big Prince fan?
I am a big Prince fan.
Yeah. Are you actually?
Yeah. Well, when I was in high school, I was really into musicology, which is not everybody's favorite Prince album. But, that's one of those albums I know kind of back and forth. Prince is, first of all, Midwest royalty. One of the greatest musicians and producers ever to live. He played like, I think, 27 instruments or something like that.
He, it's very bizarre being in Minnesota. They're still grieving to this day.
Yeah.
It's like, I understand like the death of a person that you really love. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, when did he die?
I want to say he died maybe 5 years ago, something like that.
No.
When did Prince die? Was it longer?
2016.
Okay, that was what, 5 years ago?
Six?
6 years ago? Yeah.
But regardless, it's just been, it's like, there's still tributes to this day. Like, I went to a Christmas light show, like 2 years with my friends, and like they had this huge like tribute to him still.
Yeah.
And I don't know. My parents aren't from Minnesota and they weren't huge Prince fans. So it's like all my friends that have Minnesota parents and are big 80s people, they're like still grieving it. Like I know so many parents that have like the Prince tattoo, like his logo. And I feel like it's just Minnesota's like next level.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, that's the best. I mean, Minnesota actually has a Bob Dylan's also from Minnesota. So, you know, but Bob Dylan sort of, I don't feel like Minnesota claims him as much as like New York is kind of where he got his start and everything.
Yeah. Prince is like our king.
Yeah. Yeah. And he set up studios there. I don't think Bob Dylan kind of left and never looked back. Don't Look Back. Name of his DVD special, which I still have on Blu-ray.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, don't act so impressed, anyway, Kelly.
The next week we got shows in Marshfield. We have a late show. There's tickets added there. And then the week after that, we have some left in Houghton, Michigan and Fish Creek with some tickets left.
Good deal. Yeah. So check it out, folks. We will see you on the road. Beyond that, we got Christmas coming up. If you're looking for presents, we've got all your Made in the USA Midwest merch. Go to KrebsCast.com, click on the merch section. And yeah, you'll find it there. And also, if you want to see behind the scenes, kind of some fun videos from the road, you want the first look at show tickets, make sure you subscribe to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/CharlieBarons.
Nice.
Okie dokes. Well, that's pretty good for our intro, I think. I think we did a pretty good job. And with that, let's get to my conversation with Polar Explorer Eric Larson. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Where are you at right now?
I am in Colorado. That's where I live now.
A
small mountain town around almost 9,000 feet. It's awesome. Think like Bayfield, but in the mountains.
Oh, that's nice. What's the name of the town?
Called Crested Butte.
Crested Butte. So yeah, like Bayfield. So the kind of that Bayfield vibe, or are you saying like population of Bayfield?
A lot of sailboats. Just kidding.
I was just going to say, is what the hell's going on up there?
Same vibe. Kind of like a quirky place. People real focused on outdoor stuff. It's the same, you know, like our town is like around 2,000 people. So like the whole school is just one building, K through 12, and just surrounded by wilderness, basically. So it's awesome.
It's great. I gotta say, man, you are you're nuts. You're absolutely nuts. You know, I don't know how to say it in another way, but I mean it in the best way. like watching, you know, watching you and your teammate on that excursion to the North Pole was mind blowing. The fact, to give the audience sort of just a general sense of it, you guys are carrying 300 pounds, 300 plus, 380 some odd pounds. You're pulling that sled up these chunks of ice. And, you know, on your first couple days in, you've only gone like, I don't know, 6 miles or something of hundreds of miles, and you got a tight deadline for a plane to come pick you up, or you're just stranded in the ocean forever. You know, no. I mean, it's really, I think inspiring to see how far you push, I think, the human limits of, you know, what's possible inside yourself. And at the same time, showcasing how our planet is changing. So I very much so like applaud you for that. But, you know, I think let's kind of start at the beginning. Like, where did you grow up and what inspired you to go to the North Pole, to go to Everest, to go to all these crazy places? What inspired it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I'm a huge fan. I've gone down the rabbit hole on your stuff.
Nice.
Quite a bit. And so I appreciate the opportunity, and it's fun to be able to have these types of conversations. Also, really quickly, Mr. Beast went to Antarctica last year. So I don't know if you feel any sort of competition with Mr. Beast.
But. You know what? Yeah, let me start working on that Mr. Beast money. And I'm sure that's no small amount of doubt.
I don't know how it works. If you feel a little like animosity, if you kind of support, you know, like, oh, you want, I'm sure you probably want to outdo them, right?
I can't, dude. So that's you. That's you. You are the guy who's like, I'm going to go to the North Pole and I'm going to get there faster than anyone else. Me, I'm like, oh, wow, he got to Antarctica. That's cool. Real good. Maybe I'll do that one day. You got that competitive nature, but I would absolutely love it. I actually just learned how to scuba dive this past year, and I went to the Bahamas and looked at some of the coral reefs that they're revitalizing down there with another guest on the Cripes Cast, Alana. Anyways, I love just sort of the... you know, seeing different parts of the world, especially those that kind of are feeling the biggest ramifications of climate change and all that sort of stuff. So I'm very interested in doing that, but I don't know if that's on my thing this year. But you know what? I like the thought.
Yeah. There you go.
Anyways, though, you are from Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a proud Wisconsinite. I grew up just north of Milwaukee, Cedarburg. Oh, yeah. A pretty normal childhood. I love my hometown. I love going back.
It's gorgeous, man. Cedarburg, really. They got that river running through it. The nice downtown, man. It's totally. It's like a low-key, very idyllic place to exist.
It's like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, basically. And, you know, our big line as kids was, it's the, and I don't know if this is still the case, but it was like the second biggest tourist attraction in Wisconsin, which is was our claim to fame that we wore pretty proudly on our shirts. So
what's the first biggest tourist attraction in Wisconsin?
I mean, it must be Wisconsin Dells, I think.
You can't beat Wisconsin Dells.
No, it's, you can try, but you're still just the second biggest.
Yeah. Which, yeah.
I don't know what the numbers on it. It speaks both highly and poorly of Wisconsin Dells, because I don't know what the numbers are on Wisconsin Dells to beat out Cedarburg. Is it a lot, or it doesn't seem like it would take much? You know what I mean?
You know,
it's like two more
Cedarburg's
people.
Really nice, man. You know, and they got the House on the Rock kind of in that area. I mean, you know, Rick Wilcox's Magic Castle, the Trojan Horse go-karts. I mean, it's no small feat to beat out Wisconsin Dells in this situation.
Yeah, well, we can always hope. I don't know. Maybe I'll get some of my friends to go visit and we'll just get the tally up to number one. Maybe that's a thing.
There you go. There you go. So you grew up in Cedarburg.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, I was a pretty average, probably about as average as you could get, like, just was like the slowest kid on my soccer team, and not terrible student, but pretty average. Like, no one would have looked at me and been like, oh yeah, that kid's going places, you know. They would have been like, oh, Eric, and then moved on to the next thing. So, but I think for me, I was always interested in being outside, and I was trying to figure out the world around me, and I was curious, and I loved camping, and so I was just trying to get out and do things, and back then, you know, there wasn't this big network of people, there wasn't a way to connect in any sort of real way, and so I just started doing things, and I got interested in biking. And I got a paper out and saved up a bunch of money and bought a bicycle. And then I was gone. And that was like, I mean, I was 12 years old and I was with a map and just riding my bike for, you know, 60, 70, 100 miles over the weekend. And, you know, I would go into bars and Packers game would be on and I would get a Coke and then I would be in all my spandex, you know, and and that was in the 80s. And so people did not look well at that, you know, going into some of these just kind of random rural bars and, you know, a 12, 13 year old kid riding a road bike, you know, like Lance Armstrong wasn't a thing. And, but I loved it because it was, I was on my own. I was out kind of just discovering the world around me. And I just started doing more of those things. Like I would just kind of always wrangle my friends into doing things. Like I'm like, let's canoe our river that runs through our town, Cedar Creek. But I'm like, I would get my mom to drive me up farther. And then we would like, I want to do more of it. So we would just like portage the canoe down Main Street, Cedarburg, so that we could keep going. And so I just was doing a lot of those things and was always really interested in being outside and just kind of discovering the world around me and in whatever way I could.
That's really cool. Biking was kind of the way I first got into outdoors as well. I was a bike mechanic
in
high school.
So yeah. Was I.
Oh, where at?
Well, in Grafton, and I loved that job. It was Grafton Ski and Cyclery at the time. I worked there from the time I was 16 to my mid-20s, and I was a bike racer too eventually. But that job I credit with a lot of just problem-solving skills.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything. I mean, I spent a lot of time fixing bikes, but I did sales as well. But just, you know, getting these old jalopies in there and trying to figure out what was going on and three speed hubs and blah, blah, blah. And there was no YouTube to look at. And
no.
So it was just figuring things out. But and that job also allowed me, I love bikes. I call myself the world's most boring person because when I was a kid, I loved camping and bikes. And, you know, however many years later, I still love camping and bikes.
Yeah.
But where'd you work?
I was over at few places. I did Wheel and Sprocket, and I did Willie Bikes in Madison.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't, I'm going to say, the best mechanic in the world by any stretch. Arguably not great at all. But, you know, I did my time there. No, I was okay. You know what I really like about just being a bike mechanic is, like, especially at an early age, it just gives you a general understanding of mechanics. Even if you don't have that kind of a mind, you just have a little bit more that becomes intuitive. So that's kind of fun. And when you have to, I started as a bike builder, obviously. So, you know, when you're a bike builder, it's just, did you start as a bike builder, or did you jump right
into
it?
Well, things were a little more lowbrow back then. So it was just like you were thrown into the wolves. And my boss was a great guy, but man, he was, you know, he would come around and he would look at his watch and he would be like, how long have you been working on that bike, you know? And so you knew you had to like hustle a little bit more. But I remember maybe just, starting out building bikes, but then really quickly going into repairs. Cause prior to that, I had been interested in bikes. And so I would go around and find bikes in the trash and just take them apart.
I did the same thing. That's how I got the gig. Cause I was messing around with them in my garage.
Yeah.
And then they're like, can you do some stuff? I was like, yeah, I can do this. And I was using I wasn't using the metric tools at all. I was just stripping every bolt just a little at a time. So they're like, well, first you got to do this. And I buy some of those tools.
You're like, what's the metric system?
I didn't know. I was probably, I don't know, 15 learned that. That was so funny, man. This is the best part about being a bike mechanic is you can start to Frankenstein your own bike, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I remember, I don't know what my dad was thinking, but thankfully he just didn't say much of anything, but I took his bike, and this was like, I started working in the late 80s. And so that, like, I have pictures of our bike shop, and it was all pink and yellow and, you know, fluorescent colors back then. And we had this like cable housing that was fluorescent pink. And so I took my dad's bike and I, you know, put fluorescent pink cable housing and all the brakes and derailleurs. And then I wrapped his bars in like fluorescent yellow and he was just like, okay. But it worked well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very bike mechanic thing to do. Just totally. Like make it look like unnecessarily weird, you know?
Oh yeah.
Semi-flashy. Well,
and back then we had, there was no real, like the cool factor was just tacky, straight up. Tacky. Yeah. So we didn't really have any sort of elegance or style. It was just like, oh, here's these like fluorescent colors and let's put on our Oakley razor blades. And, you know, I mean, they made seat covers for a while that were just like these nylon things that were like leopard, like pink leopard skin seat covers.
Oh, I've seen those with the little, with the zip up. You cinch them in the back.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you know, that was the hey, I think a lot of those ideas came straight from cocaine, you know.
Yes,
I
mean, definitely. Yeah.
that was just like the stock market was booming, Wall Street, they're like, let's put leopard skin seat pads on these things, so sell like hotcakes.
Yeah,
as they and go people, do another people bump did in it, the bathroom.
Man. I mean, we had like a jar of them and people were buying them. And then it just ended, you know, it was like that. The only way to quit that stuff is like cold turkey, you know, you can't go to rehab for that. You can't, right. You know, you just gotta like, and then it was done. And then we were in like forest green and maroon, you know.
Kurt Cobain was like he was the cold turkey of it all, you know, the totally. Grunge scene came around and then people were done with it.
Yeah. Side note, when his album came out, I was in college. And my friends and I, when we heard like that song for the first time, we were like, what the hell is this? We couldn't believe it. It was the most amazing music that we had ever heard. It was incredible. It was cool.
You know, we actually had Butch Vig on the podcast and he was talking about he's become a friend over the years, and he was playing that. He tells a story about playing that in Wisconsin on Lake Monona for Billy Corgan and the Smashing Pumpkins, and he just played it. And as soon as it turned on, they were all just listening to it. Never mind. And then as they just listened the whole album, and then when it was done, Billy Corgan was like, "Why don't you play that again?" And they listened to it all. I mean, it was crazy. It's such a show-stopping tune, you know?
Totally.
I don't know how we've been in this conversation for like 15 minutes now and have not even discussed the most important things, but it's nice to get to know you a little bit. You know?
Well, my kind of life philosophy and job philosophy is if it costs money and wastes time, I'm generally pretty interested in it. So the tangents are how I like to live my life more or less, you know? So
you're a bike mechanic, and you're in Wisconsin and you're doing your thing. You're exploring on the weekends, biking around. And do you just slowly get more and more aggressive with your explorations?
Yeah. I mean, it's a slow burn, you know. Unfortunately, I don't have the exciting, like, I opened up a book or like someone stopped me on the street or whatever story. I got involved in a couple of groups that were doing trips. My family did a lot of camping as well. And then by the time I was in, high school, I started planning my own trips with friends. And so we did a trip down the Namekagon and St. Croix River. And then we started going up to the Boundary Waters. And, you know, at first it was like a week and then it was a couple weeks, you know, and it was just amazing. I kind of think back on those times. I was just so green. I didn't know anything. We would get lost, turned around, you know, like whatever, get caught in storms, have accidents. And I loved every minute of it. I loved it. And I was also, I think another big Wisconsin thing, which I've heard you kind of mention, which I think is part of where this all comes from, is this idea of up north, you know, like everybody always talks about going up north. And so I was always really interested in going farther north and just kind of that transition into more wilderness. I always loved it. And going up to northern Wisconsin and just being in more wild areas. And as a result, I was obsessed with Alaska too, and which was, you know, the kind of the last frontier of wilderness. And I also read a lot of books. I read a lot of expedition books, exploration, adventure books. So I had all these things in my mind. But when I graduated college, I got a job in Alaska as a backcountry ranger. And then my world just opened up because I was like, oh, this is what a mountain is. You know, I had never really seen a mountain before. I hadn't been out of the Midwest. You know, I had been nowhere. And then I was just like, man, this is amazing. And I, you know, was howled at wolves and was had close encounters with grizzly bears and glaciers. And I was just like, man, how can I get more of this stuff? And I realized there that if you were willing to accept, you know, uncertainty, like if you didn't have a straight path and you weren't necessarily worried about making money, there are a lot of opportunities that exist out there, and all you got to be willing to do is take them. And so that was kind of the path that I was on after that. And, you know, it wasn't like just going up. There was a lot of setbacks. You know, I was making no money so much of the time. And, you know, it was back then, there was no such thing as a tiny home. I was living in a shack, and, you know, it wasn't a status symbol, or living out of your car wasn't like van life. It was just like, you suck, you know? And, so it was challenging, but that was kind of the trajectory. And I eventually got into, I wanted to be somewhere where there was more winter. And so I moved to Grand Marais, Minnesota. A neighbor from my hometown was building a cabin. So I went up just as a odd job and doing some carpentry work. And I just happened to stumble into this job at this resort as a dog musher. And, you know, then I was like, man, all the things kind of clicked together. I was like, I'd never even seen a sled dog.
Yeah.
And it was crazy.
So you were in Alaska at this point, and you went to Minnesota for more winter. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I came back. Well, it was, you know, it's hard because you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, I had gone up to Alaska, and that was my kind of first big experience, you know, out on my own after college. And I had planned on staying up there, but I wanted to come back and see some friends and, you know, do all the things that I thought I was missing. And I ended up getting stuck in Wisconsin with no car and whatever. So I didn't get back to Alaska. And so, you know, there's always a little kind of roadblocks in the way. And eventually I would end up in northern Minnesota. Yeah. So I don't have too many regrets, because all the bad things get you to the good places as well. But I always think, man, I could have ended up in Alaska, and I've been back many times and whatnot, but it's every time I go, I'm like, oh man, this place is awesome.
Yeah. I love how, you know, you're always kind of have been, you were always obsessed with up north, and you got to the most up north place you could get to on Earth.
Yes, that's true.
The North Pole.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for let's dive into that. So this was a Discovery that put out this that you shot this for? Yeah, it was
So I've done a bunch of North Pole expeditions. I did one in 2006, which was the first ever summer North Pole expedition. I did another one in 2010 as well, but the North Pole for me has always been just this unique environment that's so unlike any other place on the planet. It's just, you're traveling across an ocean that's covered with a thin layer of ice. It's brutally difficult. And so a big part of my mission is kind of telling stories of places and connecting to people to these places that are so, you know, distant and kind of out of mind of people. And so I really wanted to film and share the story of an expedition to the North Pole. And that was kind of the trajectory that I was working on. And I just got lucky. I got a call from Animal Planet at the time, which is a Discovery Network. And they're like, hey, what are you doing that would make a good movie? And I'm like, have I got the story for you, you know? And so they're like, well, here's like a very tiny chunk of change. Go film it. And if you come out alive, we'll see if we can make a movie out of it. And so they didn't want to take the risk of any sort of bigger commitment, because they're like, well, we don't know what's going to happen. And I'm like, well, that's the beauty of it. You know, that's what a real adventure is. There's an uncertain outcome. We had kind of set some big goals and also we're filming it. And for me, that was really the most important, was to be able to tell a story of that place through our journey, which is kind of that personal connection, to really help people better understand what it was like. So, and it turned out well. I mean, I think the narration is a little over the top, but, I think the story, it's not fake reality, you know, like we weren't up there staging anything. We were filming it all ourselves. It's a challenging environment just sitting there, let alone trying to do all that other junk. And so, yeah, I'm proud of that. And it was many years ago now, but it's still something that I look at as one of my biggest accomplishments, I would say, or bigger accomplishments for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there were a few things that stuck out to me as just, wow, this is an incredible landscape. And you guys are mind-blowing, the risk that you take. You know, you're standing on that rubbery ice, you know, yes. And this is ice that connects two different ice chunks of the North Pole. And, you know, you're basically, if the ice cracks, then the salt deteriorates the ice, you know, but you're basically on these skis on this rubbery thing. And then you actually swim, you get in the water in a dry suit and you swim, I don't know, 100 yards to the next thing. And you get out and you pull your other buddy, over. I mean, polar bears, you know, like you had polar bears tracking you a few times in the thing. I mean, these are some really intense environmental, I don't know, it's so wild, because I've done a little bit of sort of the backpacking and all that. I did the Appalachian Trail. I did the Bighorn Mountains. And even just being maybe 10, 20 miles out in the wilderness, when you're climbing up, we were climbing up a waterfall. I was climbing up with my buddy. I was like, man, one slipped rock.
Oh, yeah.
I'm done, you know?
Yeah,
but
totally.
Maybe, you know, a helicopter could come probably. Where you are, no. I mean, if you get hypothermia, you're dead within, you know, an hour or something. I don't know. It's just insane the kind of risk that you guys were taking. Do you just get to that gradually over time, or do you have something that's always been inside you?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, first of all, risk, I think, is relative, to your knowledge, experience, and preparation. So
you're saying I'm an idiot is what you're saying, which I appreciate. I am. You figured
I don't necessarily like to call people out right away without knowing them that well, but if that's what it comes to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
No, you're not an idiot. You're just inexperienced. No, I'm just kidding.
No, that's also true. That's also very true.
I mean, where, you know, there's the classic line. It's like, where does good judgment come from? And it's bad judgment, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a level of risk in being in those situations and being so far removed from any sort of, you know, rescue. That being said, it's calculated, and it's also, you know, a function of our experience, our training, you know, our ability to deal with uncertainty and kind of unknowns as they come up. And I do feel you get better at that, both physically from like, oh, I can do this and fix this, to philosophically, which is just kind of like taking a mental hand and pushing down all that fear and anxiety to be able to go. And so, you know, my first North Pole expedition, I was skiing on the ice and I was just crying the whole time because I was so scared. And slowly you just start getting better at it. And, you know, and it's not like I just went to that North Pole for the first time. I mean, I was doing all sorts of camping trips. I was going to the Boundary Waters. I was backpacking. I was riding my bike. I mean, all this stuff. And so it's this process of getting there. And that, and I would say the risk for my types of expeditions are, you know, a little less than, you know, say someone on the side of the mountain with no rope, you know, they sneeze and they fall 1,000 feet. I fall like, you know, a couple feet and then I brush the snow off the ground and keep going on. But
right.
It's an interesting process overall for sure.
Folks, it's officially November, which means that hunting season is starting. And what better way to start your day than Jolly Good Fruit Punch, maybe a Jolly Good Sour Power. Regardless of which Jolly Good you choose, I can gosh darn guarantee that you'll be there and they will be there. The Jolly Goods will be there to help you get a buck this year. All right. And don't quote me on that. I'm not liable, but, you know, it is my go-to drink in the deer stand. I'll tell you what, and it should be yours too. Jolly Good Soda. Find them at jollygoodsoda.com.
Wow, that was really good.
Thank you very much, Kellen. You like that ad read?
Yeah, who wrote it.
You wrote it. Yeah. Dang, that was really good. And speaking of hunting, oh my gosh, Fleet Farms got some stuff for you. It is almost time for all the hunters to get out into the woods and begin their hunts. And Fleet Farm has everything you need to make this year's hunt a success. Check out their huge selection of hunting gear, from firearms and ammo to trail cameras and hunting blinds. You'll have gear you trust, and you can trust that that gear will get the job done and bring home that game that you might have missed last year, okay? You're not going to miss twice, I tell you what, because you got Fleet Farm on your side, plus they got apparel to get you covered in camo or blaze orange from head to toe, keep you comfortable and hidden from them deers. If you want this year's hunt to be a good one, make sure you stop first at the Fleet Farm. Fleet Farm, we love it. Folks, finally, if you're looking for hunting gear still, you got to go over to CripesCast.com, click on the merch section. You're going to get all the greatest hunting gear by yours truly. It's made in the U.S. stuff. It's good. It's good. It's great quality. I'm not even going to say good quality. It's great quality. Anywho, we got our Watch Out for Deer collection of items, from T-shirts and hats to koozies and socks. We've got blaze orange beanies for the deer blind, as well as army green and black. We've got the Stormy Cromer for anyone trying to do it old school Elmer Fudd style. And we've also got blaze orange Buck the System shirts for all you gun hunters.
Love it. And also, if you're more of a deer camp kind of guy, we also have cribbage boards, Midwest Survival Guide, Charlie's book, and also his card game Card Sale to shoot the breeze if you're not really that talented
if you're
at
not shooting.
Shooting
the deer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the card sale game is great for the deer camp guys. It's a fun way to kind of bring everyone together.
Yep.
And, you know, get into fights the old fashioned way.
Yeah.
You know, over a game of cards.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's get back to the Cripes Cast. You've been to the North Pole, as you said, over the past, first time was in 06, or when was your first time to the North
Pole? Yeah, 06. Yeah.
Since 06 and since going back, what are the changes that you've seen in the North Pole specifically as it relates to climate change?
Yeah, I mean, the nature and character of the ice is dramatically different. So the first thing is, and if you read back to some of the historical expeditions from the 1800s, 1900s, and even in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you see that these people would go across a big, huge sheet of ice, and it would just be huge and miles across. And then they would come to kind of one of those transition zones where those two pans or sheets of ice would collide up against each other. And then there'd be huge blocks of ice. It's called a pressure ridge. And then you get over it and be in another big sheet of ice. And we saw that a lot in 2006 as well. We would ski for miles across these big pans. And over time, the ice has become thinner. And so what you see now is that ice, as it moves around, it breaks up more and becomes more fractured and pressured. And so you don't see these big extents of ice anymore. You see less big flat areas and more just continual rough patches. You also see, you know, again, we don't see this as much, but just kind of from satellite data, as I look and plan trips, like where the extent, the overall extent of the ice is definitely shrinking. And then you just look at weather patterns. I mean, there's kind of a mentor hero of mine who went to the North Pole in 1986. It was minus 80 at the start of their trip.
Wow.
They wore the soles of their boots off in the first couple of days because the snow was so dry. It was like sandpaper. And, you know, now you might see, it's variable, you know, weather is variable and climate is more the general pattern, but, you know, maybe minus 50 or minus 40, minus 30. So just the overall kind of temperature changes. So there's dramatic changes that are happening, very significantly for sure.
And as you kind of, you know, I think the question is like, when you go to the North Pole the way that you did and you made it, you know, as several times in this show, and you've done other things too, but I'm just kind of focusing on the North Pole right now. When you go to a place like that, or I guess we'll throw in, you know, Everest or Antarctica, you go to these places, what is your purpose in doing it? Is it to just go farther than you could ever go before? Is it to kind of take something from that and show it to the rest of the world? And if it's the latter, what is it you're hoping to show to the rest of the world?
That's a good question. And it's evolved over time. I think for me, overall, you know, my background is in environmental science. So I was always very focused in environmental education. So that was kind of a big part of my life. And I got into adventure. I always wanted to do expeditions, but I wasn't like, hey, what's got two thumbs and is totally awesome. You know, I wasn't trying to make it be the Eric show. I was just trying to get people interested in these places. And, you know, I had taken a global climate change class when I was in college in the early 90s, and they were talking about the same science in 1992 that we're talking about today or whatever. And what I stumbled on through, you know, either being a guide or, you know, a straight up educator, was that adventure was a really powerful hook to get people interested in these places and these issues. You know, it doesn't matter what your political background is. It doesn't matter what your ideologies are. You can be interested in adventure, and then we can kind of talk about some of these bigger environmental issues. And so that's always been my personal platform and objective, and it's changed over time as the economy changes and people's, you know, philosophies changes, and, you know, the science necessarily hasn't changed, but the acceptance of science. And so, you know, initially it was just like, hey, let's just get people to believe that global warming exists. We'll take a canoe up to the North Pole, mm-hmm. and we'll show people just that image. And that was like our goal, you know? And then, you know, it spanned to more, you know, kind of political initiatives and things like that. And honestly, even now, just simply, which is maybe less important, but also more important, is just getting people excited about winter and the role that, you know, cold weather plays in our life. Because a lot of times people talk about global warming, they're like, oh yeah, great, I hate winter anyways, you know. But what often is misconstrued with that is that, you know, cold weather, the polar ice caps, those are parts of a healthy planet, and that helps regulate global temperatures. And so my kind of focus has evolved. And simultaneously, I do like this kind of personal push of trying to do difficult things and the challenge of that. It's like fixing a bike, you know. It's like, how do you put all these pieces together so that you can kind of move forward through this environment and achieve this really difficult objective that most people said you couldn't do?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, speaking of that, of difficult tasks that most people say you can't do, I kind of think as a planet, we're sort of in, you know, being dropped off in the North Pole a little bit. We got to make it to the North. And there's, you know, we're dragging behind us probably like a 5,000 pound of just, you know, people either, it's either a mix of denying that climate change exists or saying, well, it's happening. The hell can we do about it anyway? Or saying, well, financially speaking, it's not going to impact me. Or, you know, there's a million reasons for inaction. And now there's kind of a new one, which is just sort of giving up, you know, looking at the reality of even in America, like we're coming on a new election next year. And it's like, wait, we're thinking of putting what people up again? Like, do we not learn, you know, like, and it could be on both sides of the political aisle. Do we not learn? You know, people have just given up. So fighting against all of that, how do we move forward? And are you optimistic about the future of the planet?
Yeah, I'm by my nature, I'm an optimistic person. And so I choose to be optimistic because I think the, you know, the opposite doesn't really help the situation all out. And I, you know, for better or worse, look at myself as an example, not of any sort of shining thing of the best thing, but I'm a completely average person with a little below average mental capabilities. And I've been able to do some pretty difficult things. And so I believe in kind of our ability to overcome great obstacles. And, you know, there's a lot of those things or ideas from expeditions and to overcome these big obstacles that I think apply very well to our society. And, you know, like inaction just isn't an option. And so, you know, one of my mantras from expeditions is just begin with one step. You know, you just got to take that first step. And so that's kind of what I encourage. But I do agree with you on the political side of things, because what we need is we need everybody from the bottom to do a little thing. And we need the stuff coming down from the top. We need the rules and regulations, the initiatives, you know. And so it's kind of this two-pronged approach. But, you know, I always say, again, from an expedition, is the best way to be successful is to not have another choice. And, you know, we're in this situation. And we don't have another choice. So we do need to come up with a solution. And quickly, and like I said, keep making that individual effort for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you're right. Coming at it from the, two fronts really of course we need the governments around the world to act in some cohesive way, but trying to get government follows people. Well, actually it follows money. And, you know, at some point people will have more money than lobbyists, and then maybe they'll listen to the people, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I think that is important. And even looking at like our own lives, and even like, I love, you know, and I know you love, these, camping expeditions, all that, but, you know, even in the adventure world, these things take carbon, you know, it takes flights. Yeah. It takes, you know, I went to Wyoming. And, you know, you got to balance, like you're flying out there, flying has a huge impact on the earth. A lot of the little stuff is wrapped in plastic. There's all that. How do we kind of balance the love for adventure and getting outdoors with kind of like the obvious fact that it's taking sort of emissions to get there? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the first thing is nobody's perfect, you know, like nobody's the shining example of how to live a life, and how to be the best environmental advocate or earth steward or whatever you want to call it. So just acknowledging that, I do think these little efforts help. And I think understanding a little bit about this idea of need versus want. What do we need to survive versus what do we want to survive? I mean, we're surrounding ourselves with all these things. And, you know, at a certain point, we don't necessarily need all those things. And I'm on that same boat too. I mean, I am a bike lover. I love photography. I have cameras, you know, like, so there's, you know, being a consumer is part of society, but how we choose to live, I think is important. And, you know, there are a lot of individual things that we can do as well in terms of offsetting carbon you know, things like that, that do have an impact. My thing I got to say, and it seems so silly, but like, I know you're a big Quick Trip guy, but you know, anytime, is it Quick Trip? Is that?
Yeah.
Quick Trip. Yeah. Is just like, you know, if I have a can of something, like, don't throw it away in that trash, like recycle. That's a pretty easy thing to do. Most places just keep it in your car or whatever until you get home and recycle it. So it's a little thing. But you know, I do think kind of that mindset is important. And I also think the connection to nature, I mean, the being outside, walking in the park, going on a backpack trip, going for a bike ride, bird watching, whatever it is, like all those things build a connection to our planet and nature. And that's a vital part of us. And so when we're more connected to that, we're more concerned about that rather than kind of, you know, closing ourselves off or whatever.
Right. What do you think nature has and wilderness has and gives people? Why do you think it's important?
Oh man, it's a great question. It's a great question because I wouldn't call myself an old curmudgeon by any stretch, but I feel a little reactive at times. And so I spend a lot of my time, I train a lot on my bike. So I spend a lot of time on my own just thinking. And I'll come across, like, or if I'm hiking, there'll be someone with like a speaker on their backpack, you know, and they'll be hiking in the woods and that music will be blaring and I'll be having this quiet moment. And so that always gets me thinking, like, well, what's the value of silence? Like, part of nature is being quiet. You know, we live in a world now where we have, you know, 24/7 stimuli and electronics. And so just having that time where there isn't any of that is important. You know, and the list goes on from there. It's like, you know, discovery, discovering things, whether it's a plant or a scene or a place. I think nature has, you know, presents the opportunity to make mistakes. You know, that's another thing today. We're so afraid to try things because we don't want to look like idiots. And, you know, we were talking about this with kind of risk earlier, but I mean, I made so many mistakes on some of my early adventures and still to this day, I do, you know, where we come up short or get lost or who knows, take the wrong gear. And, you know, there's, I think a really important part of nature allows you to be able to do those things without any sort of like criticism or whatever. And so I think the list goes on and on in terms of like the value of nature and we're animals, you know, like we're connected to nature. Like that's part of who we are. And I don't know about you, but man, I'm busy. I'm on the computer all the time and I get out and all of a sudden I'm like, I just feel better. You know, I feel more relaxed and my mind clears up. I'm happy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like, God gave us nature for a reason. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like, as we've seen in society, and I'm no doctor or anything. So if anyone's like, oh, what the hell is he talking about? You know, I don't really give a shit, but this is my opinion is that we're all on our phones. The more we're on our phones, the more, what do we see now? Anxiety, depression, suicide, right? Rising. Why? Because we're like living here and this is a miserable, miserable place to live. And, but out there, you know, there are several studies that say just being in nature calms your anxiety. That idea of being bored, boredom is where creativity comes from. And even on another level, you look at all the diseases that have been solved and cured based on things that they find in the rainforest, for example. It's like everything is there, but, you know, yet we destroy it to make more of these screens, you know, which... I'm looking at you on a screen. So I'm part of this too. And, you know, I'm part of the deal.
Both of our lives are focused on that. How do you balance your time? Because you're living in a very digital world as well. I'm very curious about that because it's something that I wrestle with as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm very lucky to have a great team. One of my team members is looking at me right now that luckily do a lot of the technology aspect of it. I mean, yeah. I started off doing all of that and then got to a pretty good breaking point on that. And then over time, you know, I still do a lot of it. But, you know, it's just nice to have a team to sort of share in that and very help. I couldn't do it without the team is really what it comes down to. But for me personally, the time I personally,
by the way, that sounded like a hostage statement. What you just
you should see the way she's looking at me. You're right, like, now.
She's you like, gotta hold up a newspaper so I know that it's actually today. I need
I do very much so mean it. I do very much so mean it. I just can't. If you look at Colleen right now, and it, you know, for people who listen to the podcast a lot, they know that Colleen and I have a very interesting dynamic in the intros where she gives me hell all the time. So she keeps looking at me and giving me a weird look, and it's making me self-conscious. But the truth of the matter is I really do. I couldn't do without them, and I think they do great.
Of course.
But yeah, there's really something nice about turning it off and just going outside.
Well, I have kids. And which is the most amazing thing for me. But I grew up in a time, my buddies and I talk about this all the time. We're like, how lucky were we that nobody had phones? Oh, yeah. And nobody was recording any of the stupid stuff that we did. Mm-hmm. Because we would not be, you know, I would not be living a free life, probably. Who knows? But I think the other part of that is, you know, we did things, and me especially, I did things because I was interested in them. So I, you know, wanted to ride my bike, so I just started riding my bike. I wanted to do this trip, so I just started to do, you know, this camping trip. And that was the extent of it. And so I think about my kids, and, you know, we do a ton of outside stuff. We can't. My son is a hardcore skier, and he's 11. I mean, he's a way better skier than me. I always tell him, like, dude, I grew up in Wisconsin and I was skiing in jeans at Little Switzerland, you know, like, you have all the best gear and you're on a 12,000 foot mountain, you know, right. There's
step
just no
off.
Yeah. And he's like, come on, dad. And I'm like, and I'm literally scared looking at the stuff that he's like basically going backwards down.
Oh my God.
But anyway, so I think about it with my kids because there is a balance. I mean, like, I love technology. There's a lot of good aspects of technology. But you see that them get sucked into it pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And so I do really, but I do believe in that connection to nature for an individual level, but also in terms of, you know, kind of a global health environmental level as well.
No, I do think, and also I thought this is where you were going with that, but back in like when you were growing up, when there was no social media, you did stuff because you wanted to do stuff. You didn't necessarily do stuff because you wanted a picture of you doing stuff. And I think that changes how we interact with, things. And sometimes if we sort of scrape the surface of an experience to sort of get a picture or to put it out there, as opposed to really doing it because you genuinely want to do it. I mean, maybe there's a difference in that as well.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to be negative about it, but there's kind of this hyper reality that exists, where you're just creating these situations just for the image and you're not really diving in. And I, so much of life happens below the surface, you know, and that's part of the reason why I do these long expeditions. Like, how do you get to know a place? Like, you can kind of get to know it by driving across and looking out the window and whatever. And on a bike, you're a little slower, hiking, you're even slower, and you kind of understand what this hill is. But when you're in a place for, you know, a week or a month or 2 months, like, you really begin to understand the nuance of what that area is like. And I think that kind of permeates into all life. There's just, it's not right or wrong, left or right. There's so much more nuance and everything. And so we're just not getting it. And I will say, I don't mean to blow sunshine up you, but that's where I was sick for a couple years and I was looking at some of the stuff and it was just brutal. And that's when I think I started stumbling on some of your stuff and I just found it really funny and engaging, because it wasn't like, hey, I'm trying to be this certain thing. I'm just having a good time and, you know, kind of pointing out some quirks of our place or whatever. And so I really enjoyed that, actually.
Oh, thank you.
It was refreshing for me.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm glad it could, I'm glad I could entertain you a bit with that, you know. It's nice when you come from that place and you see those things. And I sort of stumbled upon that, you know. I didn't realize people would take to it the way they did. So I got lucky in that regard. It's that sense of home, you know.
Totally.
What is the craziest thing you've ever encountered out there in the wild?
Crazy is a relative term. Okay. You know?
What's the closest you've come to a near death situation? Let's start. With that.
I mean, I've had polar bears jump on my tent while I'm sleeping in them.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, polar bears, you can't think about any of these things. Like you get kind of a little gallows humor going on. You're like, oh, that was close. Because if you stop and like really be like, oh man, then you start getting pretty nervous. But yeah, I mean, there was a time where this was off the coast of Russia and we were just in this crazy situation. It was all this open water. Wherever there was open water, there were seals. Polar bears eat seals. So there's lots of polar bears around. And what they do is they jump on kind of these ice chunks when the seals are having the babies and they smash, because the seals have their babies underneath, and they smash the seals under there and then they eat them. And so this polar bear like basically did that to the front of our tent, you know, the vestibule, the part that we're not necessarily sleeping in, but so the whole tent kind of caved down on us. And you know, I woke up and was somewhat alarmed. And
Wow.
But I've had, a lot of polar bear encounters. I've had a lot of black bear encounters over the years. I've been chased by a moose, you know, avalanches on Everest. You know, it's just like the more you're out, the more stuff that happens. But I will say I'm a pretty careful guy. I'm not the guy jumping off the cliff and being like, woo-hoo, you know, like,
yeah, right.
I'm a slow chess game guy. I mean, I don't know if that's because I'm from Wisconsin or if it's just the nature of my personality.
It's a very Midwest of you. Very Midwest.
Oh yeah. 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 It's, well, I have to explain this
one. Cautious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to explain it to my wife all the time, because she's from the East Coast and she's like so straightforward and, you know, doesn't, you know, always tells it like it is. I'm like, you could sugarcoat it a little bit, you know, like doesn't hurt to say one nice thing, you know. So I'm like, you got to, and we'll go back to the Midwest and we'll go into the gas station and she'll be like, why was that person being so nice to me? I'm like, that's just how they are, you know. She doesn't get it.
that does take a while, especially from the East Coast. There's a little bit of a learning curve there.
Yeah, she's just like, am I, you know, what's going on here? And I'm like, no, just get used to it. It's gonna happen everywhere.
We're almost at time here, but I wanted to ask, you know, sort of your advice for people who are, you know, maybe like the outdoors and they're looking to kind of start their first adventure. Maybe it's a solo hiking trip. Maybe it's going to a mountain they've never gone to before. What would be, you know, your top tips for kind of a new experience and one you're unfamiliar with?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, Wisconsin's a great place to start. Anywhere is, really, but there's so many cool areas all over Wisconsin. But I think my big tip is just to get out and do something, anything. Don't let the idea of it like impede your ability to just go out and try. And ultimately just starting small. Like I've seen so many people want to do these big trips for the first, you know, it's their first time out. And then they just get into that first hour and it's just overwhelming. Their pack's too heavy. They got the wrong gear, whatever it is. And so I think, you know, a great thing is just starting small, you know, go on a little hike, go on an overnight, you know, not even a long overnight. We do this with our kids a lot. We'll just go drive up the afternoon. We'll hike 3 miles up a mountain, set up camp and come back. It's like 23 hour thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's not this big consequence. So I'm a huge fan of just, and we'll even just set up our tent in our backyard and sleep out there. Like I got my kids winter camping when they were just like 2 years old and we just were in the backyard, you know? That's and, cool. So I think that's a big thing. And then there's, you know, now there's a lot of stuff online, obviously, even though we were just dissing online, there are a lot of great resources and there are also a lot of groups, where, you know, you can go out and learn from other people for, you know, this didn't really exist when I was in school, but I know just if anybody's in college or university or even high schools, I think have some pretty awesome outdoor programs and getting involved there. And, you know, doing whatever. But ultimately, for me, my biggest advice is just get outside, just go do something and keep going.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you and follow you?
They can find me in my tent somewhere cold, probably, because that's where I like to be. Yeah. If you Google my, I hate my website URL, but it's old and I'm redoing it. It's from like 1980, but ericlarsonexplore.com. But I do the whole Instagram or social EL Explore. You can just Google Eric Larson, Wisconsin.
Awesome. I think
my name comes up.
Perfect, man. Well, hey, yeah. Thank you so much. And is that, I should have asked this before I asked that last one, but is there anything, you think I should have asked about that I didn't, or any final thoughts that you have?
I was surprised to, cause I, like I said, I went down the rabbit hole. So I was really interested. I was glad that we got to talk a lot about the environmental stuff. Cause that doesn't necessarily happen. And I thought the other topics would have been like Midwest beauty queens. Yeah. that was like, how am I following this lady on Instagram, this Alex Worley? And I was like, why is this lady keep popping up?
Oh yeah.
And then I found out that you had a connection to her, which
yes, I did.
Which we don't need to get into now, but I was very, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I don't know. I got lost. And then we touched on Mr. Beast. So I will say I do this. If you're ever interested, I got this great polar training course up in northern Minnesota. It's awesome. Yeah. If you want to come, I'll send you the information.
Please do.
You just come with. Cool. It's in January. Okay. I would love to have you and just expose you to some of that stuff. And it's a good resource for other adventures, like kind of the style of stuff that we're doing really applies to any sort of other adventure. But I appreciate the opportunity to kind of talk and I was psyched because as I went down the rabbit hole, I was like, oh man, this guy's pretty interesting and got some similar interests. So I was psyched.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We do have similar interests and I've become very rapidly a big fan of yours. So congrats on everything that you've accomplished and will continue to accomplish. And love the environmental stuff too, man. It was awesome to talk to you. And I send me that. I would love to check that out, that polar thing. All right.
Cool,
man. Thanks again. Yeah, thank you. We'll talk
soon. Have a great day and eat some cheese for me, please.
Yeah, I will. All right. Right back at you now.
All right.
All right. See ya. That is it for this week, folks. Special thanks to Eric for coming on the show to talk about his expeditions and his travels. And I might just have to go do that polar excursion class he was telling me about. I got to find the time.
Yeah.
But I would love to do that. And if you guys want to do that with Eric, just give him a follow at EL Explore and on Facebook, Polar Explorer Eric Larson. Check out his book also, On Thin Ice, An Epic Final Quest into the Melting Arctic. And check out his videos and clips and his adventures, everything at ericlarsonexplore.com. Finally, folks, you can find us at Cripescast on all platforms. Check it out.
And thank you all for listening. I could not do this without all of you and Colleen. Couldn't do it without you, the EP of the Cripescast.
Thanks, couldn't do it
without Hannah Milos, the editor of the Cripescast. You guys do a wonderful job. Thank you. And once again, thanks to all of you for listening. Everyone stay safe out there and watch out for deer. We'll see you soon.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down. Just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin. The Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.